The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme, 2018 is the year we're marking the centenary of the Representation of the People Act. That piece of legislation 100 years ago saw some women in Ireland getting voting rights for the first time. On tonight's show, we'll trace the origins of the suffrage movement and look at the lives of its key activists.
She had contacts all over the world with women's organisations, supporters of women's suffrage. Everywhere the women were organised, Mrs. Skeffington got there.
We'll explore this struggle for women's empowerment as it took place all over this island, highlighting individual stories and the resistance that suffragettes faced.
They are supposed to be shielded by their male relatives from most of the hardships and disabilities of citizenhood. There is no reason why women should have any direct part in the policy of the state.
And, in light of this centenary, we'll reflect on women's rights in Ireland over the past 100 years. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. We begin this evening with a voice from the RTE archives. In this clip, Maud Gonn, an advocate of cultural nationalist and suffragist causes, describes what it was like for her as a female activist in the 19th century.
I want to say a word about the almost unbelievable anti-feminism of the 19th century, which refused to allow women to be members of any national society, constitutional or revolutionary. I always worked as a freelance, for I had been refused membership of the National League, Parnell's great organization, and of the Fenian organization, and even of literary clubs like the Contemporary and the Celtic Literary Society. Because I was a woman.
And there we heard Maud Gonn, who was an activist on so many levels, describe her own difficulty, and indeed the difficulty for women in general, in being accepted into national organisations simply because of their gender. Maud Gonn also showing that the word feminism didn't just emerge in the 1960s. I'll be joined throughout this programme by four guests. In a studio in Belfast is historian Margaret Ward, a visiting research fellow at Queen's University. She's editor of the recent book Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, Suffragette and Sinn Féiner, her memoirs and political writings. That's published by UCD Press. Joining us from Cork, from our Cork studio, is Professor Linda Connolly, director of the Maynooth University Social Sciences Institute and author of the book From Revolution to Devolution, The Irish Women's Movement. Joining me on the line from Meath, where she is currently snowed in, is Claire McGing, specialist in gender and politics, also with Maynooth University. And in studio is our own researcher, historian Liz Gillis. You're all very welcome indeed. Margaret, terminology first, suffragist or suffragette, as applied to the 20th century movements, which do we use, which should we use, which is more proper to use?
Oh, it just depends on who we're talking about, Miles. If we're talking about the non-militants movement, then they were suffragists. And in fact, at the early part of the movement, everyone was a suffragist. It was after the Pankhurst organisation, the Women's Social and Political Union, militants went to jail. The Daily Mail, in a term of derision, called them suffragettes, meaning to belittle what the women were doing, and they decided to take it as a badge of honour. So it defines militant women, and in Ireland, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and others defined themselves as suffragette and called themselves that when they were talking about the work that they were doing.
OK, let's take it back to, Linda, the 19th century and the roots of the movement here in Ireland. In the 1860s, we see some of the first suffrage societies in Britain. And it's sometimes said that the Irish movement began as women here were influenced by these early suffragettes or suffragists, as they would have been then, across the water. But is there more to it than that?
Good evening, everybody. Absolutely. We tend to look at feminism in terms of waves rather than, if you like, specific events or countries. And the first wave of feminism certainly dates back to at least the 1860s, including in Ireland, where you see very early campaigns around, in particular, the right to education. We see in the 1860s as well, campaigns starting to object to the Contagious Diseases Acts, which basically involved compulsory inspection of prostitutes, which in the spread of STDs, etc., was explicitly, I suppose, seen as the double standard. Why were the women, so to speak, being examined, of course, and there were men involved as well, particularly in the military. So that was actually a 20-year campaign. You also saw campaigns around women seeking greater involvement in municipal structures, things like poor law guardians. So many of the women in this period, they would have had a memory of the famine, of abject poverty, and they were very involved in philanthropic causes. But they also wanted to seek participation in the governance of such institutions. Also, the campaign, the precursor of the vote for Parliament, of course, was the campaign for women to vote in local government. So you see, very important, I suppose, is what we might call all of these campaigns, which were rooted in Irish society at the time, providing the breeding ground for the later causes that emerged. And we see the first public suffrage meeting in Dublin in 1870. As we heard there, Maud Gonne as well, she came to Ireland in 1888. And at the time, nationalist organisations excluded women. So I suppose what you have leading up to the achievement of suffrage in 1918 was this, I suppose, prehistory, a first wave, a wider first wave women's movement, which provided the circumstances in which women could mobilise within their own movement.
What about women and property and the capacity of women to own property? There was a concept in the late 19th century called couverture, which basically meant that once you married, you did no longer owned whatever property you brought to the marriage, whatever money you brought to the marriage, you didn't own it any longer.
Exactly. And, you know, somebody once said marriage, in a sense, was more to do with economics than romantic love right into the 20th century. Marriage was an economic transaction in many respects. If we look at the dowry system, for instance, you know, the transfer of the bride from her family of origin to her family of procreation was elaborate exchanges. Again, the chattel, the notion of chattels, effectively in Victorian law suggested that women were actually owned by their husbands. So women had very limited rights within marriage. We see as well, you know, women could be committed to asylums without their consent.
Claire, although women were not allowed to vote at the turn of the century, the 19th into the 20th century, there was a peculiarity in the sense that they were actually permitted to stand in certain elections as poor law guardians. Just explain what a poor law guardian was and why women, although they didn't have the vote, were allowed to stand in these elections.
Good evening from a very snow-filled County Meath, everyone. So the poor law guardians were established by the British administration to oversee the poor laws, essentially, in Ireland. And a particularly important part of their work, of course, was the running, everyday running of the workhouses. And Irish women in 1896, propertied women, again, that qualification of owning property is quite important in this period for women. Propertied women were given the right to stand for election as these poor law guardians. And part of the reason, or quite a significant part of the reason for this, was because, firstly, there had been a campaign predating this in terms of trying to get women into public life and giving them the right to vote, and that you know, slowly built up over the years. So this was, I suppose, the starting point. But secondly, there was a sense, and this idea was perpetuated not only by feminist activists at the time, but also by those in government who supported the reform. There was a real sense that women, as a result of their domestic role or as an extension of their domestic role, that they would be more compassionate and would be more caring in these situations. And Anna Haslam, who was often, I suppose, considered to be one of the first campaigners for women to get the vote in Ireland, along with her husband Thomas, she visited a number of workhouses across Britain. in the late 1800s, and she, or in around the 1860s, should I say, 1870s, and she noted, because women there in Britain already could stand in this capacity, and she noted how well they were run, and she really considered that to be the fact, because of the fact that women had a say and had a voice in administering poor laws and in, I suppose, the, trying to provide for those who were impoverished at the time. So that was quite an important point. And in terms of women getting that right to stand as poor law guardians, later in 1898, the Irish Local Government Act gives women the right to run and to vote in urban and rural district councils. In 1911, that's extended to borough and county councils. And all of those reforms are all used by the suffrage campaigners to try and rally for a further extension of the vote, because it became very hard for the British government to deny them that right when you had women in local capacity right across the country who were already showing that they were able and quite good at public service.
Tell us a little bit more about Anna Haslam. I think she was one of the more genteel suffragists that Margaret was talking about at the top of the programme.
Yes, well, Anna Haslam, she established in 1876, with her husband, as I said, Thomas, she established the Dublin Women's Suffrage Association, which later became better known as the Irish Women's Suffrage and Local Government Association. And Anna and Thomas Haslam were quite an interesting couple. She was from Cork, and she had been born into the Fisher family, who had been quite important in famine relief. She had been involved in soup kitchens in Cork, and she had grown up and had been instilled with a real sense of social justice and equality from quite a young age. And herself and her husband, they were both Quakers, and many of the social reformers of the time, particularly those who were involved in campaigns around women's right to education as well as the right to enter into public life, were Quakers. And they were involved not only with campaigns around women's equality, they were also involved with trying to get the Contagious Diseases Act, which Linda already mentioned, repealed, again because they saw this as a double standard on women's sexuality in comparison to men. Anna herself was involved in trying to get education for women. They were in favour of birth control and also had been involved in the anti-slavery movement. So they were involved in a wide range of social causes. And as I said,
but she wasn't particularly militant, or at least she might have been militant in her ideas, but she wasn't militant in her methods.
No, absolutely not. And the association that they established was moderate. And this, again, would have been reflected in the British movement too, where it became much more radical later on. But the early movement for suffrage was much more moderate. It was around establishing or setting up petitions. It was about lobbying. It was about writing letters to MPs, etc. And that is very much in contrast to what would come later with the establishment of the Irish Women's Franchise League in 1908, which was established by Hannah Shee Skeffington, her husband Francis, along with their friends Margaret and James Cousins. Interestingly, Hannah and her husband Francis had both been members of the Haslams organisation. They were there quite early on, but their politics became more radical over time. There was also, too, the point that the Haslams organisation, they themselves were unionist. Their suffrage association was predominantly Protestants, and the Sheehy Skeffingtons and the Cousins felt that there was a need for something not only more radical, but also an association that took the particular colonial relationship into consideration in terms of how the Irish suffrage movement should proceed.
Although I think the Cousins were Protestants as well, weren't they?
They were absolutely. But again, it was quite a diverse organisation, but again, would have been much more radical and more nationalist in orientation than the Haslams.
Margaret, would the likes of Hannah Shee Skeffington have scorned the moderation of Anna Haslam? Would she have had any time for her?
Oh, she called her our dear old leader. No, they were very, very close. I mean, Hannah was a member of the Haslam organisation for a number of years. Carmel Quinlan, the biographer of the Haslams, describes them or contrasts them. She says they were part of the dying fall of Southern Unionism and the Franchise League were part of the buoyant vibrancy of self-confident nationalists. But for a number of years, and you can see the letters, Anna Haslam to Hannah, asking her to speak at different meetings. Eventually, she leaves in 1909, and it is really because of the Unionist way that the organisation was. They had talked about our colonies in one of their annual reports, and Hannah wanted that change. There was a political disagreement, but by that then they had set up their own organisation, the Franchise League, and Hannah and Margaret Cousins actually went and had the courtesy of going to tell Anna Haslam that they were setting up this new organisation that would be militant and would be suitable to the situation of Ireland, a subject country seeking independence from Britain. Because, of course, Anna Haslam, as a unionist, was not seeking independence. She was seeking votes for women within the context of the Act of Union. But, of course, Home Rule comes into the equation very quickly, and the Franchise League are talking about home rule for Irish women as well as Irish men, and they're also taking their inspiration from across the water with the Pankhurst, with the Deeds Not Words, are really saying, as Hannah says, the limits of constitutionalism have been reached by 1912 when the Home Rule Bill is published. Women are not going to be given the vote, and militancy starts as a consequence.
You've a lovely anecdote in your book on Hannah Sheehy Skeffington about a visit by Anna Haslam to Hannah in Mountjoy.
Yes, and so when she's in jail, and this is really, you know, quite exceptional, women are in jail because they have smashed windows on their own behalf, as Hannah puts it. She smashed the windows of Dublin Castle, but Anna Haslam comes to jail and says, "Don't think I approve, but here's a pot of verbena and here's a pot of jam, and I've made it myself, but I don't approve of militancy." But you can see that she was a caring woman and concerned, I think, about Hannah's welfare, comes to jail to see how she's getting on.
Tell us a little bit about Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, daughter of an Irish Parliamentary Party MP. So I suppose in that sense, an unlikely radical.
No, but David Sheehy came from a Fenian background. He and his brother Eugene had been imprisoned several times for their Fenian activities. They were part of the whole land war era. So she came from a militant background. Her own mother, Bessie McCoy, had been active in the Ladies Land League. And Hannah's first memory, she said, when she was a chit of four, is going with her Aunt Kate Barry to Kilmainham Jail with the Ladies Land League lunch hampers. And her uncle Eugene was in Kilmainham at the time. So she comes from a rebel background that she's very proud of. And then when she's a student and is asked to sign a petition that is going to Westminster about getting women the vote, she realises for the first time, she says, that she's actually on a worse status than lunatics and criminals, because she, as a woman, will never be able to vote, and they'll be able to, you know, when they come out of jail, etc. So she starts from that point of view, that understanding that the vote is important, because women, she feels, have been disregarded by organisations because they're voteless, because they have no sanction. And although she and Frank and their student friends joined the Young Ireland branch of the United Ireland League, which is, you know, linked to the parliamentarian system, they struggle within that. They don't want women there. And, you know, and by 1909, she's talking about the importance of women fighting for their own rights and not being part of any of those organisations. And she talks about the alienation of women from the Irish parliamentary system. And in fact, David Sheehy, parliamentarian that he was, never once voted for a woman suffrage bill when it came before the House of Commons. And you can see the record of the Irish Party, because
dismal.
There are Absolutely. Well, you see, there are some. Willie Redmond, for example, was a supporter of women's vote, although John Redmond was firmly against. There were bills.
I think Tim Healy as well, although he made a few also defending them.
And he defended them. But Tim Healy actually did continue to vote for women. But in 1912, when a conciliation bill was going through the House of Commons, and British and Irish women thought at long last, this is the third bill. There was one in 1910, there was one in 1911. This time, some women are going to get the vote, and the Irish Party votes, 35 members vote against, and as they say, the Irish Party killed the conciliation bill. It was a terrible blow to British and Irish feminists, and John Redmond was the one who instigated that. He didn't want anything to interfere with the Liberal government promise to get Irish Home Rule, and so women were discounted in that. Mm. And even later on, Philip Snowden, a Labour MP, in November of 1912, he put forward a private member's bill to give women the vote in the Home Rule Bill. And this time, 72 members of the Irish Party vote against that. So you can see that there was a complete rift then between the Irish Party and suffragists.
At a time when they had quite a bit of political muscle because they had the balance of power.
Of power, indeed.
51551 for your texts. And at RTE History Show on Twitter, text from Thelma to say, don't forget that not all males could vote either. That's true. It was the 1918, the Representation of the People Act was property-based. And 99%, Thelma says, of the entire population can't vote in our Senate elections. So that's true as well. Now, in the years leading up to the Representation of the People Act, there was some tension between advocates of nationalism and suffragism, as many thought that suffrage for women should only come with an independent Ireland. Let's hear a clip from the RTE archives. Here's Sheila Humphreys, who recalls joining Cumann na mBan and how that group never lost sight of its main goal.
I joined Ranelagh branch of Cumann na mBan. I was very, very, very happy in Cumann na mBan after that. Of course, everybody was, because what they call now solidarity was something extraordinary. You had a completely new idea of life. It was what you could do for Cumann na mBan and what you could do for Ireland, and nothing else mattered. Nothing else.
It was suggested that in Cumann na mBan you weren't interested in developing the members as women.
Well, that's quite true. I don't think we were.
Even though there were suffragettes on the other side of the Irish Sea.
Yeah.
That wasn't a priority.
No, I have to admit that it wasn't at that time. The one priority was to get our freedom.
Interesting. That's Sheila Humphreys there when pressed by the interviewer Hilary Orpen, asserting that the main goal of Cumann na mBan, at least in the short term, was freedom and not attaining voting rights for women. Liz Gillis, did nationalists encourage women's political participation?
Well, with the exception of the Home Rule Party, the Irish Parliamentary Party, you do have some encouragement of women being involved in and having active political participation. If you look at Sinn Féin, there are women on the Sinn Féin executive in the Irish Citizen Army. You do have a women's section of the Irish Citizen Army. Of course, the volunteers, you don't have women actively involved in...
Well, was Cumann na mBan sort of the de facto Irish volunteers, female division?
For want of a better word, yeah. You do have the forerunner, of course, being Aoife na hÉireann, set up by Maud Gonne, which is a hugely important organisation.
Tell us a little bit about Aoife na hÉireann, because it's an organisation, it comes up, you hear about it quite a lot, but I don't think that much is known about it.
To me, it's one of the most important organisations at the turn of the 20th century, and Maud Gonne sets this organisation, based primarily in Dublin, very militant group of women, and primarily they are a republican group of women, but they're also feminists, and their whole mantra is to get an independent Ireland, and they are hoping to be part of the struggle that will come. But a key feature of Aoife's work is also this sense of addressing the social issues at the time. So they're realising that there's huge poverty in the country. Education isn't on the agenda for the ordinary working class people, certainly the young boys and girls in inner city Dublin. And they decide to change this because they realise how important education is to furthering your chances, because they had access to this. And they have links with Aoife na hÉireann, Countess Markovic, who's a member of Aníonna, co-founder of Na Féinne, and you have this relationship building up between Na Féinne and Aníonna na hÉireann. And then the boys who join Na Féinne become the officers in the Volunteers when that's set up in 1914. So you have a tradition of a strong relationship between Aníonna na hÉireann and Na Féinne. But also when Cumann na Mban then is set up in 1914, Aníonna don't go away. They become a branch, and a very militant branch of Cumann na Mban. And they're the one branch of Cumann na Mban that's active on the south side of the city when it comes to the Easter Rising. But one thing is, these women never, ever, ever lose their sense of social justice. What Maud Gonne sets out to achieve with those women from 1900, those women carry that right through to the end of their days.
Mm. Linda, talk to us a little bit about women's groups, perhaps suffragettes acting as a catalyst for women's groups, but the extent to which feminists of this period campaign actively on issues, for example, like sexual abuse, domestic violence, that kind of thing? Or was it all to do with suffrage, suffrage, suffrage?
Not at all. I think what you find is even within individual women, they hold very complex views in a number of issues. If you take Constance Markievicz, for instance, she was actively engaged in issues around provision, really practical material issues around poverty. But she was also, as we know, a feminist who was very early involved in suffrage in Sligo, and also a nationalist. So what you'll find is we tend to, I suppose, set these different groups apart or against each other in the dominant history. But in fact, you find activism across a range of spheres. This is not unusual in what we call, I suppose, periods of revolution or activism. So I think it's very interesting as well to look at how as well some of these groups conflicted with each other as well. Again, I'll use Markievicz as an example, for instance, who was active in the Irish Citizens Army, strongly criticised, for instance, what she called the subordinate role of Cumann na Mban in a speech in 1915. She said, "Today the women attached to national movements are there chiefly to collect funds for the men to spend. These ladies' auxiliaries demoralise women, set them up in separate camps and deprive them of all initiative and independence. Women are left to rely on sex charm or intrigue or backstairs influence." So you have very, I suppose, different interpretations of the role of women vis-a-vis the other movements and causes of the day. And suffrage was just one of a number of questions and issues that existed within that broader context.
OK, stay with us. After the break, we'll continue to tell the story of the women's suffrage movement in Ireland.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show here on RTE Radio 1. We're talking about the women's suffrage movement in Ireland. My guests are Claire McGing, Liz Gillis, Linda Connolly and Margaret Wards. 51551 for your text. We've heard quite a lot so far about the political opposition to the suffrage movement. Let's hear an example of some of the social stroke religious opposition. This is an excerpt from an article in the Irish Ecclesiastical Record in 1909 by a Reverend David Barry.
On Catholic principles, it is not explicitly defined that woman has the right to a living wage or the duty of supporting herself at all. She is supposed to be shielded by her male relatives from most of the hardships and disabilities of citizenhood. As a wife, the efficient discharge of her duties under the fourth commandment renders it impossible for her to make her own way in the community. There is no reason why she should have any direct part in the policy of the state.
And that is from the Irish Ecclesiastical Record in 1909, Father David Barry. The fourth commandment, the reference there is to keep holy the Sabbath day. I'm not sure how that would have rendered it impossible for a woman to make her own way in the community. Margaret, just a couple of things. A newspaper called The Irish Citizen. How important was The Irish Citizen in the campaign? The title itself, I think, is interesting too.
It was fantastically important. I mean, it It was edited by Frank Skeffington and James Cousins, and it really was to, you know, tear away that paper wall of silence. It was so difficult for women to get properly acknowledged in the normal press as to what they were doing. The Irish movement didn't have much money, so in fact the money to set up the Irish Citizen came to them from the British suffrage movement. And the as you say, the title Irish Citizen is deeply significant. At this stage, neither male nor female in Ireland were citizens. They were subjects of the Crown. So they were doing two things. It was a nationalist and a gender-specific call. And it was talked about from men and women equally, the rights of citizenship, but also the duties of citizenship. It wasn't simply about women claiming rights. It was also about what women were going to put into making society better. I mean, the vote was a symbol of freedom, but it wasn't an end in itself. And you were talking earlier about what else they did. One of the things that was really important was the Watching the Courts Committee that they set up, where they, Marianne Duggan in particular, who was a non-militant suffragist, like Christabel Pankhurst, had a degree in law, but because she was a woman, couldn't practice law. They went to the court and monitored what was happening at this all-male system where men who had beaten their wives would be getting off, men who had perpetrated desperate sexual abuse against small children and incest were not getting the proper kind of punishment because men were sympathising with other men and there were no women there to even act as the voice of the children. It was a very powerful message at uncovering something that Irish society preferred not to talk about.
Claire, talk a little bit to us, if you would, about militancy, Irish militancy. Obviously, in the UK, you had the sacrifice of Emily Davison, who dies by throwing herself in front of the King's horse. You have hunger strikes. You have an element of violence. Was that reflected in Ireland as well?
Never to the same extent. I mean, the issue of hunger strike is quite an interesting contrast between the British and the Irish case. So in Britain, I suppose, dating from the foundation of Emmeline Pankhurst's women's social and political union, this much more radical form of activity, and they engaged in law-breaking, you know, arson, smashing windows, etc. And the system didn't really know how to respond to so many women going into prison. But a number of them did, and quite large number. So the figures are that between 1905 and 1914, the British state responded by putting 1,000 women or over 1,000 women into prison. That was never to the same extent in Ireland, where between 1912 and 1914, 27 individual suffragettes on about 35 occasions were in prison. So it was never to the same extent as would have been the British case, albeit significant. And in 1912, in June of 1912, there was 8 Irish women suffragettes, including Hannah Shee Skeffington, and they throw stones at a number of government buildings across Dublin, and they are given sentences of varying lengths. Now, at this point, they do not go on hunger strike. Their conditions, all things being said, are actually quite good, at least in comparison to their British counterparts, in part because Dublin Castle wanted to avoid conflict and to avoid any kind of publicity being generated. But where things do get a little bit more militant, where they do start to engage in hunger strike, and the consequences of that comes in July when the Prime Minister Asquith comes to Dublin to address a Home Rule meeting. And 3 women from Pankhurst's organisation come over from Britain and they throw a hatchet. And it's Hannah Shee Skeffington writes that the hatchet skimmed between the Prime Minister and John Redmond, and it actually skimmed Redmond's ear. And they were jailed in Mountjoy for this. But the Irish women, the Franchise League, though they were much more cautious, they had organised a more peaceful form of protest. They were wearing black rosettes and so on. They get caught up in this, and 8 of those women are also imprisoned at the time. And there's a real question about whether or not these women should they, and the 3 British women, should I say, go on hunger strike. And there's a real question about whether or not the Irish women should go on hunger strike. Rock in solidarity, or should they? They were only imprisoned for about a week. They got very short sentences. The British women, much longer sentences. And in the end, they're split on it. Four women who were due for release in a couple of days, two of those decide to go on hunger strike very enthusiastically, and two go after a bit of soul searching, including Hannah Shee Skeffington, and four others decide not to because two of them are in poor health, or the other two just on principle decide they were not going to do it. And the Mountjoy authorities at the time, they do enforce force feeding. However, to try and negate the negative publicity, they do it when the Irish women have been released. And when one of the women on the short sentence from Britain, a woman called Lizzie Baker, when she has been released, so only two of those women, Mary Lee, who had gotten 3 years, and Gladys Evans, who had gotten 6 weeks, undergo force feeding and are released after a time when medical authorities become quite concerned. After that, though, there was other women, about 24 women, who were imprisoned for suffrage activity. The Irish state never force-fed again. They switched their strategy. They did two things. Firstly, they isolated suffragettes in a provincial prison in Tullamore, and they also gave them even better conditions, I suppose, to try and prevent them from going under hunger strike again.
Okay, we have a tweet from Jared Shannon, who says, in the pre-Easter Rising period, Sinn Féin was the only political party in Ireland that allowed women. That was the reason Countess Markievicz remained a member, though Griffith was no big fan of hers, being suspicious of her background. And when we talk about the Irish suffrage movement, we often talk about those high-profile women like Markievicz, like Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, and very often other women who don't make the headlines are forgotten. And our reporter, Rona Tarrant, has been speaking to Dr. Leanne Lane of DCU about one woman who wrote her own story into the history of Irish suffrage.
The name Rosamund Jacob might well have been forgotten if it wasn't for her diaries. Born in Waterford in 1888, she lived through dramatic changes and documented all of it.
She used the diary as a confidant. It is one of those lifelong diaries.
And the cast of characters in her diary makes up a who's who of nationalists and radicals, people like Constance Markievicz and Liam Mellows. But throughout her life, Rosamund always felt like a secondary character.
She had all this intellect, she was so well read, but I think she increasingly felt that she hadn't achieved something and she had that outsider status.
Rosamund grew up in a Quaker family where she developed a passion for women's equality and nationalism, which from the beginning put her on the outside at the local Protestant school.
She wears pins, nationalist pins on her clothes going to school, and this leads to her being taunted and stones flung at her.
Rosamund was mostly homeschooled, and as she grew up, her social excursions were mostly to local activist meetings.
She was involved in a lot of the cultural revival activities, so she was involved in Sinn Féin, she was involved in the Gaelic League.
She moved towards a more advanced nationalism as she grew older and brought these views to the suffrage movement she was involved in, as evident when in 1912 she wrote about the activities of three English suffragettes in Dublin.
They threw a hatchet into a carriage in which Asquith and John Redmond were travelling, and they set fire to the Theatre Royal, and Rosamund denounced them as getting involved in a country they shouldn't get involved in.
There was a real conflict at the time between women who identified with both the suffrage movement and the nationalist movement.
Can you ask for the vote, form an English parliament, without saying then that that parliament has the right to make laws binding in Ireland? And many nationalist women said you couldn't.
Including Rosamund, who still attended suffrage meetings but decided not to join officially.
These women argued that actually what had to happen was a staged approach, that Irish women had to fight for the national cause first, Irish independence be achieved, and then women ask for the vote from their own parliament.
Rosamund watched the nationalist movement in Dublin closely and took regular trips to the capital, including one in the aftermath of 1916.
She's absolutely horrified at what might have happened to her friends in Dublin, and she, as quickly as the trains start to run again, goes up to Dublin and goes around to check where people are.
She finally moved to Dublin in 1919, where her housemates included Hannah Shee Skeffington and Dorothy McArdle.
She attended Gaelic League meetings. She gets involved in left-wing politics. She writes for Publook. She's desperate to actually fit in, but she finds herself just doing errands for those who are more established, which irritates her.
As well as activism, Rosamond also wrote novels, though her books didn't really sell.
While she mixes in circles of women writers, she's all the time watching other women be successful, and she's not.
Rosamond never married, though she did have a relationship with the Republican Frank Ryan. It began when she was 40 and he was 24, and they kept it a secret.
At one point, Frank Ryan arrived late at night and she was sharing an apartment or a flat with Dorothy McArdle at this point, and Dorothy went berserk on her, blasting her out of it, saying that, you know, it was scandalous for a woman to have a man calling to the house late at night.
In her diary, she swoons over Frank and his Limerick accent.
But she did kind of then, for all her principle, kind of wait around for him. You know, she'd run back to the flat if she thought he was arriving.
But the love, it seems, was unrequited.
It was sad, the descriptions of Ryan. I think she really did love him. But he actually left to fight in the Spanish Civil War without even saying goodbye to her.
Rosamond never really addressed not finding a life partner in her diaries, but she did write an unpublished novella called Third Person Singular.
It deals with a woman kind of waking up late at night, realising that the time has passed during which she can have, no, she doesn't say marriage, but a great love affair. And this woman lies awake looking at the kind of vista in front of her as somebody who has failed in this regard.
And Rosamond had reason to be dejected. She felt the Ireland of equality that she had fought for didn't materialise.
As she grew to old age, not having married in a free state Ireland, later a republic, which very much placed women's role within the home, there were very few options open to her.
Rosamond remained a presence in activism until her death on October 11th, 1960.
She died crossing the road while reading a book. Kind of is, you know, it's tragic end, but she still had her head stuck in a book.
Rosamond Jacob died without seeing the fruits of her generation's work, but she did, through her diaries, finally become part of the story of Irish suffrage, though unfortunately that didn't happen in her lifetime either.
Rhona Tarrant speaking there to Dr. Leanne Lane of Dublin City University, who's the author of the book Rosamond Jacob, Third Person Singular. It's worth noting the diaries of Rosamond Jacob are now housed in the National Library. Margaret, as we heard there, Rosamond Jacob was a housemate of Hannah Sheehy Skeffington when she moved to Dublin, when Jacob moved to Dublin. How would you assess her role in the movement?
Yeah, she was an independent spirit, a very thoughtful woman. I was thinking, listening to all of that, the earlier period, the suffrage period, there were a lot of letters between Hannah and Rose, who was still in Waterford. And in fact, Rose's mother, Henrietta, also engaged a very spirited debate in the pages of the Irish Citizen. And what you get from Rosamond Jacob is this very thoughtful. She's saying, well, yes, Cumann na mBan will be to blame if they don't insist on being represented on the volunteer executive, but we can't have nationalist women, you know, being blamed for not for being criticised by English women. We can't have the Irish Citizen calling nationalist women slave women because they're not, you know, calling out the volunteers, but equally we can't have nationalists calling suffragists Irish traitors because they're putting women before the nation. So I think she was trying, she occupied what I would think is a difficult position as she tried to see two sides when you had very, very strong women on either side, and she found herself a little bit caught in between. It all changes after 1916 when suffragists and feminist nationalists come together. We don't have any more that home rule issue. Everyone is united in wanting Irish independence and wanting the ideals of the proclamation to come into reality. And you can see then that they're very closely concerned. Rose, for example, wants Hannah to be on the list of women to be elected in the 1918 elections. They're both very concerned at how few women are in Sinn Féin and how few are stood for election. So that she's very strongly feminist in her views and very strongly nationalist, and as you say, becomes increasingly alienated from the Free State as it develops, as does Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, and they move towards the radical Republicans of Anne Foblocht, of Frank Ryan, Padraig O'Donnell, etc., which I think is a difficult space for women to take at that time. They didn't have that many women also taking that space. Later on, Hannah in particular moves back to feminism as she fights against the Free State Constitution and all the different laws governing women in the Free State, and stands as a women's candidate in the 1940s. Right. But I think Rose Jacob hasn't had her due. I think she is somebody deeply interesting, and it's great that she wrote, and we have so much that we can mine in terms of what she was saying about these years.
I've been taken to task on the fourth commandment. I said that it was keep holy the Sabbath day. Now, I have to say, and it has been pointed out by a number of people who've called in, that the fourth commandment is honour thy father and thy mother. Now, I have to say two things. One, I didn't know what the fourth commandment was. I looked it up in Wikipedia. Wikipedia told me and still tells me that it is keep holy the Sabbath day. But however, having said that, it makes far more sense in the context of what the Reverend David Barry was saying, that the fourth commandment should be honour thy father and thy mother. So I defer to our listeners. Who cares about Wikipedia? We'll take a break.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
And we are talking about the centenary of women's suffrage and the Representation of the People Act passed in February of 1918. Margaret, was that down to militancy, to the militancy of the suffragettes, or was it down to World War One and the involvement of women making the case for the vote for women unanswerable?
Well, when you read the debate, you know, women only come into the debate on the Act quite late on. It's really about updating registers and making sure that the men who fought the war are given the vote. And so even young men as young as 19 who are still in the forces are given it. And then, you know, they remember women, if you like. And some of them do say we don't want to return to suffrage militancy. They recognise there is still a movement out there. It hadn't gone away, that women were making representations throughout the war period. So there's partly that, and there's partly a recognition that women had proven their capabilities during the war in terms of their war work. Although, in fact, by putting the age restriction of women over 30, they were in fact rewarding a lot of the women who had been doing war work who would have been younger women. So, you know, there's an element of hypocrisy there. But I think what they were saying was, well, we now can see that women, you know, aren't necessarily ones to be sheltered in the domestic hearth. They actually can go out and do their part in the world. But they were afraid that they would be overwhelmed by a female electorate, and so they have the age restriction, and of course it's still a property basis that they have to be property owners or married to property owners or occupying property with an annual value of £5. So women are about 43% of the electorate when it comes to the actual election, rather than over 50%.
Wind forward, I suppose, Margaret, from the 1890s, when people like Jenny Wise Power were poor law guardians, and ask the question, I'll ask the question, maybe you can answer the question for me, why 22% of the members of Dáil Éireann are female?
Well, it's I wouldn't say that, you know, there's so much done about it, and we talk about why is it? Is it because of cultural reasons that parties have not been welcoming of women? Is it the confidence of women? Is it the fact there are all sorts of barriers to women, like, for example, childcare? Is it, you know, that you need money to stand for election? There are all sorts of issues that are there. But when you think of women in the early part of the Irish state who were welcomed and were formed part of an overall movement, would Hannah Shee Skeffington, having been a Republican judge in a Sinn Féin court, one of the first things the Irish Free State does is the Juries Act of 1924, mm-hmm. which restricts women from jury service. So she said, I was expecting a new state to bring forward all this progressive legislation. Instead, what we have is negative legislation about women, so that the early state showed it didn't want women in the public sphere. It blamed women for the civil war and all sorts of things. And you had a new generation that were so much more conservative than the leaders of the proclamation. And so I think you have something that changes the political culture in Irish life and has made it difficult for women. So political parties have had to be put on the spot. And the quota system is one of the ways that parties have been challenged now to encourage women to come forward.
And I'm afraid there we have to leave it because we have run out of time on this evening's programme. My guests were Margaret Ward, Linda Connolly, Claire McGing and our researcher historian Liz Gillis. Thanks tonight to Kieran Cullen on sound and our reader Mark Manning. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. Until the same time next week, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy. Goodbye and thanks for listening.